Not necessarily safer. What I mean is I have to consider a lot more comparing to if I just travel by myself. And because I had a mistake last time when we were traveling with our eldest child and my husband. I accidentally booked a love hotel, which I didn't know.
Oh my God, are you serious? That is hilarious. Well, your child
It
was like, well, your
was
child was
three. He
like,
was three, so he
yeah,
wouldn't
so he,
understand anything.
yeah,
But my husband's
exactly.
like, we arrive at with a taxi, and he's like, "Okay, this looks a bit dodgy."
Yeah,
I had no idea. Yeah, but the people were nice. You know, they're like, "Oh, okay, that's a bit unusual." You know, a family with a young child coming
So
through.
did you yeah, what kind of kinky shit are they about to do?
It was just very noisy. It was backed into like a night
As in like
market.
noisy, as in like you heard people
Oh
screaming.
no, we didn't really
Oh
hurt
good.
people, but we
That
are
would be
you
so
obviously can tell
stunning.
it's a love hotel because
Ugh.
the neon lights, the
Right.
lighting, and the setting of the lobby.
Oh my God, that's so funny. That
Yeah,
is hilarious. You've never told me that story.
so
Sweet.
many things. It's just been so busy over the years that you've forgotten about it. Should we jump right into it? We were going to talk about our agendas, but I think we'll just jump
Jump
right
right
into it.
into it. Yeah, so
Yeah.
I'm very lucky and have been able to commence the new column at my masthead, Women's Agenda, where I get to watch a 90 and film from the 90s every week and
Oh, nice.
really kind of assess it through the lens of today. And the
Right.
column is called Classical Problematic. And this week, I started off with Mrs. Doubtfire, which I believe I perhaps had spoken about briefly with you, Helen. But since then, I've been going down a rabbit hole and kind of realizing the comfort of early 90s films. And I realized actually, Helen, this morning when I was going through it. So far, I've been watching Sister Act, Sister Act 2,
Oh, yes.
both early 90s films, Dave and Kevin Kline, Sigourney Weaver comedy from 1993. I kind of initially wanted to really focus my viewing on only 1993 films because
Okay.
there's just so much there. But my editor has ex encouraged me to expand and broaden the scope. But what I realized this morning, Helen, when I was going through the list, I was like, why is it, what is it about 92, 93 that I'm particularly fascinated about? And I realize it's actually the years in which we immigrated from Taiwan to Australia. So maybe, and I was like 4 or 5 years old, so I don't actually remember any of it, but maybe there's some sort of like, there's a sort of subconscious part of me that kind of marks that time in my life, 92, 93, as something that had a very big psychological, emotional effect in me that I haven't actually psychoanalyzed or haven't actually like kind of unpacked. And the way I unpack it and the way I'm drawn back to those years, the period of 92, 93 is through movies, and it's not like I watched those movies at, when I was 4 or 5 years old. I was too young, obviously. But there's a pull about that those 18 to 24 months. There's a pull that I sort of unconsciously gravitate towards,
I think that 18 months is quite crucial for our family. But then, like you said, those movies were out in 93, but we probably watched them
Much later.
much later, like
Yeah,
say
that's right.
96 or maybe
Yeah.
95, when
When they
we've
came out on TV.
That's
Yeah,
right, where
exactly.
they came out on Saturday or Sunday night, 8 p.m. Those movie nights
Yeah,
where the
8:30.
family's 8:30, sorry, where family just sit together and you watch a film and you can stay up late. I think those are quite crucial, the fact that many people don't realize that apart from school, television is probably the second source that for immigrant kids to absorb
Yes.
the local culture.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, not so much local, I wouldn't say local, I'll say like Western culture,
Yeah,
because
Western. Yeah.
very obviously white dominated. And the movies, as you've mentioned, really remind me, our family favorites will include the ones that our dad got the VHS while you were sleeping, and
While you
also
were sleeping,
Dumb
yeah.
and
Dumb and
Dumber.
Dumber.
Usually, comedy, silly kind of And also what we were watching, Jim Carrey was a huge hit back in the early 90s, I'll say early 90s, yeah. And that made a real big impact for us because that's where we have entertainment. And I think I really enjoyed Sister Act, not until I'm an adult that I realized that how much it impacted me, because Sister Act is Whoopi Goldberg will probably be one of the very few women of color that I've seen on TV back at 90s.
Back in the 90s, yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember seeing any people like Australian, truly Aussie people of color that appeared on TV.
I mean, it still doesn't appear.
Yeah, it's still very rare.
Yeah, let's not like, you know, let's not deny what is truthful here.
Mm, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said. And we really were shaped by American culture, weren't we?
Because definitely. Yeah, very much.
Yeah,
so.
Like where we came from, Taiwan is also greatly shaped by US culture.
Mm-hmm.
And when we came to Australia, I think what was most accessible, or at least what was the culture in which our family, our parents have shifted, was around American values and American kind of like pop culture.
Mm.
And like you said, a lot of the movies were in the early 90s that came out in America in the early 90s were starting to be shown on TV in the mid 90s, which is when we started kind of getting older and getting, you know, being able to watch these movies. And I had so much fun. I had so much fun this week watching Sister Act. I spent about 2 or 3 days just watching the movie and having it in the background, because thankfully it's streaming on Disney. But I was like singing all the songs from the top of my
voice. I know.
Yeah. And I watched Sister Act 2. I delayed until maybe 2 days ago, because I was so excited about watching it. Unfortunately, it doesn't hold as, like, it wasn't as good as the first one, in my opinion. I was so riveted by the first one. And it's, I think it's a queer story. I've written a review about it on the Women's Agenda that will hopefully come out soon. But I think it's the best queer, sort of underrated queer movie from the 90s. Queer because, there's a lot of kind of like underlying undertones of queer sexuality between Sister Mary Roberts, who Mary McKenna plays. Mm-hmm. She's the sort of redhead with the fringe, the very shy, docile one.
Yeah.
So she and Whoopi Goldberg have a kind of, I think, a kind of romance. There's a scene where, Sister Mary Roberts, she comes into Whoopi Goldberg's bedroom and gives her like a daisy alarm.
Mm-hmm.
And like I always saw it as a very sweet gesture as a kid. Yes. But you know, seeing it through the lens of an adult, you notice a lot of things about it. And I think it's just I was brought to tears so many times this week when I watched it in the performance, in the musical numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Because like it was just so emotional seeing these women supporting other women, and like for that to be purely the central core, spiritual core of the movie, is a celebration of not just female friendship but female love and romance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which wasn't able to be explicitly stated, you know, in 92.
Back in 92.
And like you said, I think the reason why I got very teary when I watched the movie several times this week, I realized, is because it kind of captures the spirit that, like, I think when you watch a movie when you're a kid, when you're a young person, you watch a movie and you absorb it in a way that you absorb it in your body and in your kind of cells and in your heart in a way that kind of stays with you. Mm. And I think watching it now as a mid 30s person, like watching it now, I felt this week the sort of small child I was kind of surface, and the feelings I had when I was a child resurface. And then like along with that, the innocence of what I believed when I was like 7, 8, 9 years old when I watched this film, you know, that all kind of rose to the top again. And and what I mean by the innocence is that when I watched this as a kid, you see this black woman being a friend and being a leader in a leadership role in this film in front of a team of white women, right? Mm. And like the film is really, the comfort of the film also is what is comfortable about the film is the fact that it's kind of raceless, as in it's race blind. And so they never make a point of Whoopi Goldberg being black. Mm-hmm. And so when I watched it, I got teary because like it reminded me of a time when I was young and like race was not a thing. Like I didn't understand. I didn't know the trauma of race. I didn't know the realities of what it means to be a person of color. And so it was so like on so many levels, it was so emotional to watch this film because not only are you consuming the story on the screen, you're also kind of reliving the psychic kind of energy that you had as a child, mm-hmm. you know, and that was very emotional.
Mm. I think what you said about race blind, I kind of got to be, I'm going to be disagreeing with that because I think there's a bit of subtlety in the first film where there was kind of like a rebuff from the principal nun. I can't remember her name, Mary. They're all Marys.
Yeah, Mother Superior. Maggie Smith.
Maggie Smith, which is played by Maggie Smith. I think she kind of didn't want to accept the request from the black cop because she's going to accept another black woman into her group. I think there's a little bit of subtlety, not shown very direct, but at the same time, I think there's an intention for it because after all, it's a religion place. They want to present it as the way that they, a kind of like a representative of inclusion of everyone. That's why, you know, I guess, I don't know how the script was initially going to present it, but I guess that's why they created this black character to be accepted into the all-white nun.
Yeah, I actually disagree with you because I saw the scene. I don't think the black cop played by Bill Nunn, Detective Souther, I don't think he actually initially has any meetings or scenes with Maggie Smith's character. I think it's the white male archdiocese kind of main priest guy who has a conversation with Maggie Smith, mm-hmm. who says we have a new person, we need to protect her, and in turn the Reno police station are going to make a donation to us. Mm-hmm. And I watched the scene a few times where Maggie Smith does meet Whoopi Goldberg for the first time, and I think her abrasion, her kind of abrasiveness, her whole reaction is actually against not her skin color, but
her identity.
Her hair, actually.
It's a characteristics of a black woman.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. But to me, it feels as though Maggie Smith's character is more kind of reaction. She has a more abrasive reaction towards just the fact of her
personality,
personality, and her like openness and her kind of like because like you know they call her a lounge singer, you know, for instance, in the beginning, and you know this role was initially given to Bette Midler.
Who
I thought would have been actually fine as well. I can totally see Bette Midler pull this off. Yeah. But I'm so glad that Whoopi Goldberg did because, yeah, like we said, you know, in the early 90s, how many women of color were in the, you know, the protagonists of a Hollywood blockbuster, Hollywood, you know, big movie, big crowd pleaser. In a way that didn't make her the romantic lead, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Yeah. My daughter.
I could talk about Sister Act forever.
I know. I understand. Yeah. My daughter watched that a couple of months ago.
Yeah.
And she loved it. I don't know if we mentioned it in our previous episode, but
I think we did.
Yeah, we did briefly mention it, and she loved the Sister Act, and we told her that, you know, there's a second one, and she immediately wanted to watch it.
Yeah.
And she can pinpoint a lot of things that, as a child of 9 years old last year, I didn't think that I would pick up when I was nine. And
yeah, like what?
The lens that she's seen, she says, Like the second one, she will question that, oh, how come it's a school for mostly black children? Yeah, okay. She was asking, why don't they have to, why do they, like, because she was not grow, she didn't grow up in the environment of religion, so she was wondering why the nuns have to teach in school. Like, she doesn't get the concept of, you know, maybe religion schools or church that provide as a charity for education at the local community service. So she didn't get things like that, and she just really enjoyed it. She said that the music was great. She said that she enjoyed watching the a comedy set out between the nuns in the first one. And then when I ask her, oh, okay, so which character do you like the best? And she says, what's her name, Mary? The one,
Mary Patrick, the big one,
the big
the
one,
loud one.
that
Yeah,
one. She's
Kathy Ji
hilarious.
plays.
Yeah, she loves her. Yeah, it's
Yeah,
so
she's the
funny.
best. She's so good. And I had so much fun writing this, writing my feelings and thoughts about such a classic. I'm just looking forward to, exploring the best films from the 90s, and being able to, understand history, I guess modern history, through the lens of Hollywood films. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so from my side, I've finished Sun Mao's Stories of Sahara this week. It's a translator work by Mike, translated by Mike Fu, Bloomsbury Publication. I had a lot of feelings and thought after I read it. It's very, it really differed when I first start reading the book. It really transformed you, take you to that desolate place of a Sahara desert when you read her work, even after, say, you know, almost 50 years now that the work was first published in Chinese, and a lot of things that you don't understand. You had the translator's note was good because he wrote about where that he wants to maintain the essence from the 70s, the writing styles from the 70s, but also he needs to consider how the narrative, whether or not it's appropriate. Some of the narratives is definitely not appropriate nowadays if you speak politically correctness form. But I think Mike Fu did a great job of translating Sun Mao's Stories of Sahara, and I honestly want, you know, every woman should read it because it's about a woman's not only solo travel, because she wrote about days where she was with her husband in Sahara, but a lot of encounters that she had in the year in living in Sahara Desert. And it was just such a mesmerizing read for me. And I passed on to my daughter who was 10. Because I think everything in that book is very appropriate for her to read. There's no nothing about sex. There's a bit of violence, but I think it's not very gruesome, and she can understand it about racial tensions with local people. And I passed on to her, and she said that, oh, I told her that, oh, it's like kind of like a travel journal of a woman, and she goes, oh, okay, I want to read it. She likes reading stories of women and girls. So hopefully, if she doesn't get bored of it, she will probably finish it and we can talk about it. Yeah, so that's
Fantastic.
me. I want to quickly mention a movie that we saw. It's a rather silly incident that happened to our family last weekend.
What happened?
Because so on last Thursday, my husband came in while I was working, and he asked me that the latest Ant-Man movie is coming out soon. Do you want to go and see it with us?
The
Like
latest what?
the latest Ant-Man 3, Quantumania.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a
Oh my
Marvel
God.
movie, you know. It's
Oh my God.
not your
I can't.
it's not your cup of tea.
Not at
Yeah.
all.
So he asked me, I said, oh, okay, then we can go and see it over the weekend. And then he booked a ticket for Sunday. We turned up the cinema, bought the popcorns and bought the drinks, sit down. It was at the VMAX, you know, those the biggest screen in the cinema. And I was just thinking, okay, is this the first weekend? Because it doesn't feel like there's a lot of people. There were only about like two or three other couples in the like this humongous cinema. And then I was thinking, oh, okay, maybe because it's the first session of the day, 10 o'clock, no one's here, it's fine. Okay, so we sit down and watch the like the trailers and the ads before the movie. And the movie starts. Then 2 minutes into the movie, my husband picked up his phone because on the screen it appeared one of this old character, old actor. I can't remember his name, Carrie something. He's the lead for Princess Bride. Yeah. He said that, oh, that's him, you know, Carrie. I said, yeah, okay, shut up. Don't, you know, he tends to. This is a problem when you watch movies at your home too long and you go to cinema, you start wanting to chat and things like that. Then he start acting weird. He's like, okay, this is a bit strange. He took it out of his phone. I thought that he was gonna look up IMDb because that's what he does. He's got this really bad habit. Both of us do. Like when we saw someone on the screen that we are familiar with, we want to go and read
Yeah,
up
of
about
course.
it immediately.
Everyone has that, by the
Yeah.
way.
He took out his phone and start pressing it. I say that, put your phone away. You know, I kind of like slapping on his shoulder. I said, don't do that. And he goes, okay, I'm gonna go out. And he told me that, okay, it's a bit strange. And he walked out and he came back and he said that this is not the movie that we're supposed to see.
So what did you end up seeing?
We
Or
didn't see
what
it.
session? What session were you guys in?
No, this it's this like spy movie with Hugh Grant, Jason's what's his name? Jason Staten or Stelton?
Jason Sudeikis.
Like this, you know, the bald head, the guy who does all the, a lot of martial arts and action
No,
movies.
I don't know.
Yeah, Hugh Grant and just a, like a British spy sort of movie.
A new one?
Yeah, it's a relative new one, I think, but it's towards the end of its you know
Running time, yeah.
running time. Yeah, but we watched 5 minutes into it, and then my husband came back and said that and whispered to me, "This is the wrong session. We have to go." So he turned out he bought the tickets for 2 weeks. 2 weeks after last Sunday,
Right.
so
He got his dates wrong.
he got the dates wrong. Yeah, so we got out, and my daughter was upset for like 10 minutes, and then she says, "Oh, it's okay. At least we got popcorns and Fanta."
Okay, so what'd you guys end up doing?
Went up, went home, and watched Wakanda Forever,
You
which
watched
is
what?
another Wakanda Forever,
Oh, right,
the second
yes.
one. Yeah, which is another movie that's not Jesse's cup of tea.
Oh, I have nothing
Yeah,
for Marvel. I
you
have
have nothing
nothing.
that
They're
far.
like a disease, honestly. They don't Marvel movies have infected Hollywood like cancer. Sorry.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, but it's just, you know, a genre that my husband and my daughter loves to watch. And I actually initially didn't want to watch this movie, and we talked out a very long time to decide to see it because of what Wesley Morris said on the podcast, Still Processing, because there were
What did he say about it?
quite different. They
Oh,
say,
about it being like just 2 hours of mourning Chadwick Boseman?
About, well, actually, it was only like first 10 minutes about mourning of, you know, Chadwick Boseman's death. So, you know, you would think that how would it work without Chadwick? He's almost the essence of the Black Panther. And it's just very dull. I didn't like the script at all. Yeah, the positive part will be probably the strong whites and very tender and affectionate black female characters. And the script is it just I don't like the plot at all. Yeah, because you end up seeing two sort of like the minority nations fighting each other because, you know, a great white nation provoked the conflict between them. So there's spoilers here. If anyone hasn't watched it, you know, don't listen to the next 2 minutes. There's a sacrifice to Queen, you know, it almost feel like there's a essential death of a black woman to allow people to realize the humanity to come together. Yeah, so I don't like that. But
Doesn't sound very feminist.
I feel it's very conflicted for me to decide whether or not that the movie is reflecting on a reality, which is pretty much it is. And also my desire of to watch something that is more positive for people of color. But at the end, there is a slightly positivity. But yeah, it's just that the conflict between two minority nations and the loss of a matriarch figure, to me, it reflects the reality of our world, which I hate to see. And like I say, I'm in such contradicting feeling about this. Like, part of me think it's a good thing that it's portraying the real world, but part of me hate to see that the reality depicted on the silver screen. Like, I really desire for a plot where a black woman don't have to die, whereas, you know, the real villains, in this case the Americans, gets the punishment they deserve. But at the end of the day, this film is not about that. It is more about how fucked up the, you know, the insanity to fight for powers, you know. It's about how power corrupts.
Well, I will not be watching that. But I do want to just say, this week I had discovered, and I rarely ever discover something new that gets me really excited, so I'm really excited to talk about this new series on Netflix that I have literally been obsessed over for the last few days. It is called Kunk on Earth. It's Diane Morgan, a comedian actor from the UK, basically taking the piss out of David Attenborough-esque nature documentaries. And it's only there's only five episodes so far. So it's a miniseries. They're only 28 minutes long per episode. And I have never laughed so forcefully in so long at such frequency. I've literally watched the first episode I think 3 or 4 times now.
Oh wow, is it very short?
It's 28 minute episodes.
Oh, that's all right. Yeah, that's good.
And you have to watch it with your daughter. I hope you guys will understand the comedy of it. I know you will. I'm not sure if it's appropriate for a 10-year-old. I feel like it is. You have to go and watch it, like, right after we record. Go and watch it. It's so good.
Okay.
The script is hilarious. It's a mockumentary, basically, and Diane Morgan.
Is it a British production?
It is, yeah.
Okay,
Diane Morgan's deadpan face is just the most hilarious thing I have seen forever. I'm very excited about the show. And watch it. It's just unbelievably good. It's good natured. I love it.
Is it similar to the setting of how they do Abbott Elementary? You know, like a monkeymentary.
Oh, no, not really. It's very different to Abbott Elementary's tone.
Okay.
It's trying to be taking the piss out of serious kind of documentary makers and shows about human history and civilization that we grew up watching, you know. Watch it. I cannot recommend it enough. It's unbelievably funny.
Okay, so we'll take a quick break now, and when we come back, we will be talking about some news items of the week, and then we'll talk about, you know, something about Valentine's Day.
Yes, and Galentine's Day.
Hi there. If you're new to our show, thanks for tuning in into our program, and we hope you will stay with us for a very long time. And if you're a regular listener, we're forever grateful for your continuous support throughout this period of uncertainty. It has really helped this podcast to gain a great exposure, as our mission is to center the perspectives of people who look like us, who are marginalized historically to the sideline of conversation. So if you haven't already, we encourage you to subscribe to our podcast on Omni, Apple, Google, or Spotify, and leave a rating and review. And of course, as a small podcast program, we rely on listeners' support to continue this work. Please do check out our Buy Me Coffee page and make a donation in order for us to continue to advocate the intersectionality in the podcast industry.
Okay, so we're back. This week we've had two old white women who, one of them has inspired us, another one has irritated us. Let's start with the irritated woman first.
Oh, really? I want to start with the positive one.
Okay, start with the positive one. Off you go.
Okay, so The Guardian has come out a series of like short, I'll say they're essays, inviting writers and people in the media to write about what is happiness to them. And I actually only read, shamefully, only read one writer's essay because I think not only that she inspired me a lot, and also I really liked her style of writing, which is Helen Garner. I just want to read out what she wrote in her piece. For her, happiness is more like the things that Christians call grace. You can't earn it, you can't strive for it. It's not a reward for virtue, it exists all right. It will be given to you, but it's fluid, it's evasive, it's out of reach. It's something you glimpse in the corner of your eyes until one day you're out to your neck in it. And before you've had time to take this big gasp and name it, it's gone. I'm not going to spend what's left in my life hanging around waiting for it. I'm going to settle for small random steps of extreme interestingness, moments of intense awareness of the things that I'm about to lose and the gladness that they exist. Things that remind me of other things, tiny things, words that people choose, their accidental biblical turns of phrase, hand letter signs quoted from books, offhand remarks that make me think of dead people or of living ones I can no longer stand the sight of. And then she lists the things that she consider of what she just described. And to my surprise, she lists one of her so-called extreme interestingness. For her was the surprise of feeling my face soften at the thin music of Japanese series Midnight Diner. So she watches Midnight Diner as well. So I'm so happy that an 80-year-old white woman recognizes this Japanese TV series that we have been watching, the past few weeks. And funny enough, my daughter actually mentioned the theme music as well. She said that it feels like a very comfort sort of homecoming, warm music when you hear it at the very beginning of the series. So I can totally understand what Helen Garner was saying in her essay.
That's so beautiful.
Yeah, I
That's
love that.
such beautiful words. The ex what is she, what was the word you used? Ex she used extreme interestingness.
Extreme interestingness.
I love that. I
Yeah,
love that. I cannot agree more.
because
I
that's
always
what
like,
keep you alive, I
well,
think.
yeah, and that's what makes someone interesting is when they're interested and they can see things that are like kind of, yeah, like interesting people are like, and interestingness is just so much more like it's so much more interesting, I guess,
Yeah, but
than
you
like
also
anything
have to
else.
find that interestingness out of someone because sometimes
Yeah.
some people regard that if they tell a story, they're like, oh, there's nothing about it. It's not interesting. Then I won't talk about it. But I guess story sharing is such an important aspect in our life that it connects people and it also kind of you pass on the stories as well to someone else. It's not just that you should keep it to yourself. And I think, it's so imperative not to only for everyone to talk about what they do every day and what had happened. Sometimes when you take a perspective on your own, you might not think it's interesting. But when you have the ability to communicate to someone, like what we do here every day, every Friday, like Jess and I, we talk about things that we hope to, not so much inspire, but we just want to share our stories and hopefully someone will find us interesting.
Are you a fan of Helen Garner, Helen?
I would say that I'm not like a fan, but I like to read what she write. I've only read House of Grief and I really like her style.
It's incredible. Yeah, I came to her in when I was like in my early 20s. I think I was 21, 22 when I first read The Spare Room. And I didn't actually read it. I listened to it on audiobook. And I distinctly remember the book while I was driving to Meriden. I was teaching at Meriden at that point. And I remember the mornings when I would drive towards like Strathfield and like have that story of these two friends kind of percolating in my mind. It's very vivid for me, the story of how I came to Helen Garner. And then obviously, you know, subsequent years while she published, you know, a nonfiction, I think her best work is This House of Grief, which is really, I don't know, I feel like she's often called the Australian legend, but I don't think she's given the sort of overwhelming and universal popular love that people like, you know, Trent Dalton or Craig Sylvie are given. I think Helen Garner is a genius. I don't doubt that at all. I have tried to read all her. I went a few years ago, I went on a holiday with a dear friend of mine who's several decades older than me, and she had an entire bookshelf full of Helen Garner's past works. And I have to say, I didn't resonate with all of them. The Children's Bark was like fucking weird. A lot of stuff that Helen Garner has written just doesn't resonate with me, but that's okay. Like, I don't love everything. Like, I don't, the only writers who I love universally are people who don't actually, who are not known for books. So like Gio Tolentino, I love universally. Wesley Morris, I love universally, but they haven't written like books, you know? People who produce books, don't always, like, it's the strike rate is not 100% for me. Like Katie Kitamura, I love A Separation, I love Intimacies, but I tried reading Gone to the Forest. I didn't like it. I tried reading what's the other book? There's another book of hers before she wrote A Separation that I just didn't resonate with. So Helen Garner, like, she's a legend, and I really love what she's written in this, you know, in this article, kind of reminding us what to look out for.
Yeah, what to look out for, and don't really overestimate. Yeah, as in don't expect too much of happiness. You know, you shouldn't really seek. I'm not saying that you shouldn't seek for happiness, but I think the idea of seeking happiness is too overrated. I think personally for me, like seek for extreme interestingness.
From one to another, we're going to move from one side of inspiration to another, to the other side opposite. Someone who has not inspired us this week is a opinion piece by Jane Caro, published in The Age / The Herald. Gee, they're coming out with a lot of clickbait pieces, haven't they? Like,
I actually looked up to her before. As in,
yeah,
some of her views about Australian schoolings and stuff. But it's a bit disappointing.
Yeah. So last Sunday, Jane Caro published an opinion piece that really got off a lot of people's backs in the wrong way. It basically was a piece about her husband coming back from a trip to the butcher.
I think it was bakery.
Bakery. Who even goes to the bakery anymore?
I do.
Oh, bakery. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah. Sorry, I redact that comment. In my head, it's like the butcher.
Some people still go to butchers.
Anyway, butcher or bakery, who cares? Yeah, this is not the point of the story. Her husband was very flustered, apparently, and he was upset because the butcher baker guy. when he was serving him, was serving Jane Caro's husband, said, "And what can I get you, young man?" And apparently that just made him very upset because this guy, Jane Caro's husband, is 65, so clearly not young. And then that was like maybe 1/10 of the story, and then like the rest of the opinion piece was just like statistics about how old people are marginalized in this country. And I read it just thinking like, and the thing is, I looked through the comments. There were two, at that point, I read it on Sunday, right? Mm-hmm. I read it on Sunday and it had only been published for a few hours and there was already like 233 comments. So I was like, I wonder what other people think. And I thankfully, unlike the comments that were underneath Elizabeth Flux's piece, thankfully, the comments underneath Jane Carra's piece were comments, a lot of them echoed my feelings, which was that this is a lot of a reaction and a lot of words to a very, very small comment.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think? What do you think?
I have to, I'm a bit neutral in this, what Jane has said about her husband's incident, because firstly, I think from her age position, she probably feel like that kind of, it also depends what kind of tone that the baker was giving out. Like what sort of vibe was it, like patronizing or condescending, or was he just a very friendly, serving kind of attitude? And also because she was not, it's not her first hand experience, so I don't know if she's
right
trying to support her husband in so that's why she wrote this piece, or she was urged by editor to write something very not scandalous, but something that is like a clickbait. And then she, because of a position of age, that she is more suitable and appropriate to write about ageism. Personally, I don't like people calling me young lady, you know, or it kind of infantile my position. And that's it. I don't think if someone's just like casually saying that, and if they don't mean anything, I don't want to push so much of the political correctness to that person and say that, oh, it's so offensive, you know, you're going to correct what you said, be respectful to me because I'm older than you. Yeah, I don't think it needs to get to that level. What about you?
Well, I just thought I feel actually a bit embarrassed for Jane Carra and her husband at the moment, because like the fact of her having put so much intellectual and emotional energy into writing this big long piece, it wasn't that long really, sorry, but like just the fact that she thought it was one very small comment was enough to warrant such a huge reaction to me, basically tells me that she and her husband haven't actually faced
real ageism. A lot.
Yeah, well, no, just like any other kind of discrimination. You know what I mean? Like for her to have spoken out about this, right, just means that she and her husband have actually not encountered a lot of discrimination. Just when it comes to the kind of levels, like I in my head there's like a different degrees of discrimination, and I'd put this at the very, 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 very minor, you know, level.
Yeah.
And the fact that she has reacted and her husband reacted so strongly about it just means that they're very fragile, and that they haven't actually come across, like they've never had their race, they've never had their race questioned, or like they've never had any kind of other forms of discrimination. That's what it says to me. Just the fact that she has decided to put so much like opinion pieces, like I don't know about other people, maybe it's different for people who like have columns, like you know, Richard Glover or Jane Carra. I think she's like probably a frequent columnist. So maybe they like don't put a lot of effort into it, but me, if I was going to write a column, it's often on a subject or an incident that I have spent a lot of time thinking about, right? And for
it's
her,
not something that happened within like the space of 5 minutes going to the bakery.
Yeah, and so for the fact of this piece of writing to have existed, I think for me, like, speaks more about the lack or the absence of more severe forms of discrimination that they have they have managed to not experience, or just haven't experienced because of their straight, you know, sexuality, because of their race, because of their wealth, you know, their class, you know. Yeah, I just like, oh, I feel bad. I feel bad for them. I feel bad for them going through what I think is like pretty probably pretty bad like backlash at the moment.
Yes.
I think they're probably going through a tough time this week.
Mm-hmm.
Like having, I hope they have like the support around them that, you know, they probably do, hopefully. But yeah, I just, when I saw this, I was just like, I cannot believe this was this piece.
This was published.
Well, like that, well, just that, the fact that you, the fact that you thought that this minor comment from a service person warranted a think piece in one of the biggest publications in Australia.
Mm.
I'm a bit embarrassed for her.
I'm okay for her to talk about ageism, but I think if someone who actually experienced the real reality of ageism and read that piece, they will be like, what? They'll be like, okay, so you're really offended because you've been called a young man.
Yeah.
Yeah. Part of me still thinks that, oh, yeah, I can feel for them. They don't, like, the husband doesn't want to be called young because he knows that he's aged, you know, maybe gracefully, or he's respecting his own age and he doesn't want to be called young man. But then again, sometimes I think at this stage, it's very hard to tell one's age if you maintain yourself very healthily and your appearance. A lot of people cannot tell, you know, certain people's age. So it's hard to, yeah, I don't know where to stand in this, but I can see where you're coming from, that this piece of opinion was published, it really speaks of the privilege of the position that they can find this sort of thing offensive. And like, I don't mind that she kind of goes on and relate to other stuff of ageism, but I don't think that incident really was really that relevant. Mm-hmm. I don't know, maybe. I don't know what other people think, but because I'm not at their age yet, and again, I can't speak for all the old people.
Yeah,
how they feel.
I understand what you're saying. Just the fact that they were rattled by that, it's kind of, yeah, just speaks more about what they have experienced than anything else, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, let's take another quick break, and when we come back, we want to finish our episode with some conversations around Valentine's and the idea of romance.
Yeah.
And the illusion of romance as well.
Valentine's Day versus Galentine's Day.
We'll be right back.
Okay, so we're back. Next Tuesday is, of course, Valentine's Day.
Mm-hmm.
If you're single, you probably care about it in the sense only because, you know, it is another reminder of your lack of romance in your life, lack of kind of sexual romance, I guess. If you're with a partner, it probably doesn't matter. You might be like Gia Tolentino and not give a shit about these days. Gia writes very proudly in her book that she and her partner don't celebrate things, don't give each other presents, things like that. Valentine's Day, I do wonder, like every year around this time, there's always like kind of opinion pieces, noise, I'd say, internet noise about why is it not important anymore? Is it outdated? Romantic. I want to talk about romantic love, I guess, today versus platonic love and how, you know, romantic love is still very much seen for women as the superior love, the one that you ought to pursue most aggressively. The one that's seen as the higher status, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I guess why it's now considered toxic. I think in the last 5 years there have been quite a lot of noisy articles written, and you know, I obviously put myself in this category. I've written a lot of stuff, and that has contributed to the noise online. But yeah, I feel like I cared about it more when I was single, only because like it felt like I was like, oh, it seems like some I should do something, or like when it came, I remember thinking like, oh, I wish I could spend it with someone. But now there's this thing, I don't know how long it's been going on for, in the last few years, something called Galentine's Day, girlfriends celebration. Okay. And that is celebrated on the 13th of February, which I think is a much more interesting, and fun, perhaps, day to celebrate your friendships. What do you usually do on Valentine's Day, Helen? Because you've been married for more than half your life now.
Yes.
Does it mean anything to you anymore?
It really depends on my mood of that week. And also seeing what's out there. I like to observe the capitalism world for this. You know, I like to kind of rant about in every scenario, every celebration, it has always been commercialized and capitalized. In making money, needless to say that I refrain myself to participate in those kind of things. But then, funny enough, this year, because our local bakery, the one that we all love, Burnt Honey, you've been there, and they have the best quiche and also hazelnut tarts in the world.
Yeah.
They came out with this Valentine cake that I really want to eat, not because it's Valentine's, because they just were selling it during this week, so that's what I'm gonna do. And I just think it's like, to me, romance, it's like an illusion for most people, and the social expectation of romance is that it's supposed to be forever, but then no one really tells you how do you maintain and manage that relationship forever. It's always like, oh yeah, marriage, or you've been in a monogamy relationship, is supposed to be forever, which is quite, like you said, a very toxic idea that's stuck in a lot of people's mind and refuses to find solutions when there's problems in the relationship. You just say that, oh, as long as we're together, that's fine. So that we're constantly in conflict, and I hate that. So I always feel like romance is a very illusional creation for woman to become a property of man. That being said, of course, it's the system of patriarchy that created marriage
and romance.
And romance, obviously, yeah. So
when you think about romance, it's often like, or romantic comedies, it's often bigger gestures, or like, it's often at the end the male doing something to the woman. You know, when you think of like, oh, that's romantic, it's almost like it's a gesture committed by the man, you know. Like romance is often just like men exercising some sort of behavior and women being the receivers, you know. And but I agree with you.
For that moment, because long term, it's a reality. In the long term, the relationship in the cis heterosexual couples, the women are the ones who are most likely to be disadvantaged. You hear stories
that's why romance is like, often when someone, like the whole idea of romance is like, it's like, it is kind of like a power play. It's like the man, like when you think about the most romantic gestures, you think the proposal, right? So it's often like the man doing something for the woman. And then it comes at the very beginning of a relationship. And it's often like,
they only have to do a very short time.
And then once a man, like, I guess, like nabs a woman, you know, gets her to marry him, then
his property.
I don't mean like that. And then after that, she usually is the one who does more of the work, you know, emotional labor, physical labor, every kind of sort of labor. And so it's almost like the woman needs to be tricked into believing she is everything for the very, very like 1% of the relationship, the beginning of
the illusion.
It's like a woman needs to be fooled into believing she can, for 1 second in her life, be the center of attention and be loved in the way that she wants to be loved, for everything else, for her to be able to endure the pain of every of being in an unequal relationship. Yeah, for the next 60 years. And, you know, everything I'm saying is stuff that Gia Tolentino has said in her book, in the last essay in her book, Trick Mirror, the essay called ID Dread. And the idea that, you know, she says that it's almost like an exchange that women have been making since time in memoriam, the idea that, you know, she gets to have this one day, a wedding, where she has everything on her terms, you know, and she gets to be the center of attention and be loved universally. And then after that day, you know, she is like statistically less happy. She's statistically, you know, more tired, and everything goes downhill, basically.
Yeah, it feels
It's a trade-off, exactly. Yeah. Which is why I still always.
I don't like weddings.
Well, yeah. You seem to now have done a 360 on everything you've done, Helen. You've got married. You changed your surname to your husband's.
Yeah.
You've done everything of that, but now you've, you know, you on the other side, and
I'm always like a person that's in the sense of practical rather than romance. Like I don't enjoy big weddings, which I didn't have, and for the convenience sake, I changed my surnames, and also for my
that's what all women say.
Youth ignorant. Back in my early 20s, youth.
I don't think you were ignorant. You just didn't. You just hadn't discovered them.
I just haven't thought about it. Yeah, and like I said, you know, everyone falls for the illusion of romance, and once upon a time, I did too.
And I really love during this time it seems like the idea of romance, you know, is heightened in February because of this wretched day. And I have seen some I guess commentary online about therapists and psychologists feeling like they really don't enjoy the weeks leading up to Valentine's Day, because their clients often have expectations. Women have expectations of their male partners to do something grand.
It's really,
you know,
tiring, yeah.
And I kind of want to focus on one thing that, you know, to kind of reach the apex of this conversation, which is this idea of, you know, romance, expectations, and where that came from. And
have to listen.
And a few years ago, I think in 2019, Wesley Morris wrote a piece for the New York Times Magazine about rom-coms. And through my research, I found that in 2014, he had written another piece for Grantland about rom-coms. So in the very same vein, I guess, but in his earlier years of writing about rom-coms. And he has this great line in it where he says, in the way that porn has fucked up men's expectations of sex, rom-coms have fucked up women's expectations of love and romance.
Obviously, of course.
And I just think that was such a genius point that he drew, and it's not something that we have actually really explicitly spoken about or studied, you know, in a way that porn and its side effects for men have been, you know, researched and analyzed. Obviously, you know, porn and its consequences are much more explicitly harmful than rom-coms, you know, and their and the expectations that they have placed on women in regards to romance. Obviously, I understand that, but I think it's still a very worthy and useful thing to analyze and talk about, you know. Like when I think about the reason why I think I struggled to settle down with, you know, someone in my adult life, like I think I struggled a lot with finding a partner because I had a lot of these expectations generated from rom-coms that I grew up with. And they're not just rom-coms. I think a lot of teenage movies in the late 90s to early 2000s have had also really played with my idea of like what I was supposed to expect
and what a relationship should be.
And also fantasies, you know, ridiculous fantasies. And here I can list a whole host of movies that really kind of set me up for failure. And they include, you know, She's the Man, Amanda Bynes, She's All That, you know, probably the most famous of them all. Other movies like Mean Girls, Cinderella Story, Hilary Duff, Lizzie McGuire even, John Tucker Must Die, another big one from the UK this time, Angus Thongs and Perfect Snogging was a big one for me. What a Girl Wants, The Prince and Me, How to Deal, all these movies generally had the same kind of spiritual trope, which is that a kind of outsider or not so attractive girl ends up winning the love and affection of the most popular guy in high school and the hottest. And yeah, it's just, it's so interesting how, you know, stuff that you grew up watching as a young person takes years and years of therapy to unpack.
Okay, interesting. I never thought about that, but I do know that a lot of Asian women watch K-drama or rom-cons or romance series for the sake because they can't get the romance with their own partner. It's almost act as a vicarious sort of feeling to imagine yourself in that drama or that movie that you feel satisfied in your real life. That's what I've been observing in a lot of, because we kind of like, we're 6 years different, but I think we're in a very different generation. Like for all, most of my friends, you know, like half of them are divorced and a lot of them in relationship and some of them are unhappy. And I've heard a lot of stories. Like we share what movies or what dramas that we watched. And I think this is one from one of the observations from therapists in Taiwan as well. She said that a lot of middle-aged women, I mean middle-aged now, watches K-drama. It's because specifically they can't get that kind of feeling in their real life, and they need to have that the entertainment substitute to inject into their life so they can maintain their own relationship. It's almost as if those men who couldn't get love from their own wife, and they need to seek the love outside of their marriage. But then at the same time, they can't let go of the marriage because it's a social expectation to maintain married or something like that. So I guess how you watch romance, drama or films differs individually, I guess.
I certainly didn't grow up
liking to watch rom-coms until later in life. I'm not saying that my marriage is shit, but I'm just saying that the sort of feeling that you get when you're younger, like you, Jess, is very different to me when I was younger. I think when I was younger, I'm pretty content just watch comedies or action movies.
And I think it's so interesting we're talking about this because romance is a feminist topic. It is very gendered, you know, like when you think about romantic comedies or like the idea of romance as a kind of literary, as a kind of cultural genre in the movies, in theater, in our books, it's mostly created by women for women. It's almost like a balm or a salve that we need to give ourselves because to make our lives bearable, because being in a female body is so shit in this world, you know, because we are so biologically and culturally ostracized, you know, we fucking bleed a lot once a month, you know, like God really did not like women when he created us, you know, he made our lives way harder.
Miserable.
And so I like romances of female
comfort,
you know. Yeah, it's very comforting, but it can also be very, like, I wouldn't say harmful, but I think I'm very different to you in the sense that you're way more practical and you don't really like, you're way more practical than I am. I'm much more of a romantic, I think, than you are. And I think I've suffered for that because I've had expectations that have not been met in my life and about what, you know, what a guy should do. And, you know, it's just, it's not useful. It's really not useful to have that kind of thinking if you want kind of just to be in a equal, normal relationship that has that is based on a sense of mutuality than anything else, you know. Well, that's the end of our episode this week. Guys, we want to know what you're doing, if you are doing anything for this Valentine's Day or Galentine's Day. Much more interested to know what you guys are up to with your friends. I am definitely going to be with my best friends, probably watching a movie, my favorite thing to do.
Another rom-com.
Yeah. Yeah. Something from the 90s, preferably.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so that's the end of our episode. Remember to subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Google, and Apple, and give us a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support us, what we do here at Asian Bitches Down Under, head to Buy Me Coffee page and make a donation for us to continue the intersectionality in the podcast industry. So that's it from us this week, and we'll chat to you next time.
Bye.